Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, friends, was the voice of one of the more cogent people to walk this earth, Brian Brown, who created the Brown Briefly. Together we, the Brieflies, keep Brian's creative flame alive by bringing to you every week another episode of intelligent discussion of current events laced with humor and empathy, always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. Before we get to our introductions, please note we have a programming change today. Thank you, Claire Davis of Washington Wildlife First, for stepping in as our guest today, while our prior guest, Jenna Riggs, is currently on a mission to Mercy that includes chainsaw-enabled traveling on snow-covered mountain roads encumbered with exploding deciduous trees. Expect Jenna to join us on a future episode of the Brown Briefly. Meanwhile, let's introduce the Brieflies and our guest. Engineering the show from behind the board at the Voice of Vachon's Gene Bosch broadcast studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon's flight instructor, Vachon Airport Commissioner, West Texas Roughneck, former West Texas dancer, and current treetop flyer, Truman O'Brien. Good morning, Truman.
Wait, what was that last? West Texas. Where did that come from?
Or maybe Montana. Did we get that confused?
No, actually, I did a dance recital with 13 girls. I was probably 8 or 9.
Do you have a video of that, Truman?
I hope that they do not. but it was
archivists are madly at work.
Yes, it was at the high school auditorium in Monahans, Texas, and I had tap shoes, and oh boy, that was something else. Yeah, my mom made me do that stuff, you know. No.
Well, we did dip into the archives.
Bring up some old dirt news. Yeah.
Hey, sitting next to Truman, who you also heard briefly in that interchange, with enough past work experience to fill several of our shows, former tow truck repo man, teamster, apprentice auto mechanic, former Washington State attorney, assistant attorney general, constitutional law and torts professor, two-time Half-Bright scholar, and international arbitrator Craig Bellis. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning. Good morning to all the Brieflies. F-L-Y-S.
no apostrophe.
Inside joke.
I'm trying to decide how to spell our name.
Yeah. The Brieflies, it's easy if it's singular, but the Brieflies has several linguistic options for spelling. So yeah, we've been tossing that around a little bit. And a contributor to that, zooming in from the Southern Hemisphere, his home away from home, historian extraordinaire, owner, operator, skipper of the Vashona, president of Vashon's Heritage Museum, our globe-trotting guardian of the galaxy, and official party animal, Bruce Hallman. Please give us a Wednesday preview. Bruce?
Well, good morning. It's actually an interesting morning here. It's thunder and lightning and sort of pouring down rain, which is typical of Australia. It's very dry and hot most of the time, but what they call flooding rains, when they come, they're pretty amazing. And so this morning we've been watching sort of lightning brightening the sky as the sun's coming up. It's kind of an interesting morning.
You sound a little hoarse, Bruce. Are you okay? Do you got a cold going?
Well, actually, Pam and I have just gotten out of 5 days of isolation for COVID.
Oh, boy.
We had a little outbreak. So Pam and I and four of the students that are with us all tested positive for COVID last week. Oh, and so we've been isolating according to the policies here at the college, Newman College, where we're staying. We've all tested negative, but I still have a little bit of a hangover. It's for Pam, she had no symptoms at all. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it was sort of like one of the lightest colds I've ever had. Mm-hmm. But I still have this lingering sort of head cold kind of mm-hmm. feel to it. Mm-hmm. But testing negative, so that's good.
Yay. Glad to hear.
Wow.
Okay. Thank you for that insightful inquiry about
our... Had to come halfway around the world to catch COVID. I've avoided it for 3 years.
Oh, so, is it, you haven't had it before?
No.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Oh, wow. So there's a documentary in your future, Chasing COVID. Well, thanks for that preview. As our guests may have inferred from past shows, you are in Wednesday already in Australia. So
I am.
Yep. Thank you.
Wednesday
thank you for that look
6
ahead.
6 a.m.
All right. Hey, let us also welcome our returning Small Talk guest, Claire Davis. Claire is a founding member and current board president and interim executive director of Washington Wildlife First. She's also the managing partner for Animal and Earth Associates, a former newspaper reporter for the Oil City Derrick, former Big Firm Securities litigator, former legal advisor to Best Friends Animal Society, jigsaw puzzle enthusiast, current caretaker of Dipper, Zelda, Bethesda, Pearl, Buckbeak, Flitchy, and Scrappy, and a contender for having more credentials than our own Craig Bellis. It's great you could join us today, Claire.
Very happy to be here. Thank you, Kevin. I'm not sure if, you know, they're really credentials so much as an indication of a roving career with that lends itself to many different titles. But
absolutely. And Craig can share notes. How many jobs, Craig, have you had? 54?
54, I think.
Oh,
I counted them up.
Oh, my gosh.
There you go.
So I'm just curious, where is the Oil City Derrick written?
In Oil City, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Which I had never heard of until I got a job offer out of college to go there and work as a newspaper reporter. And should have told me something that they offered me a bonus to take the job before I saw the town.
Yeah, that probably is a good hint, isn't it?
That's a great name for a newspaper.
Yeah, I love it.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's just south of where oil was first discovered in the U.S.
Yeah, I knew that was the case. Mm-hmm.
All right. And then the trend, of course, continued from there. Well, Claire, I'm glad you could join us. Let's see. Mine is the voice of Indivisible Vashon and the Vashon Climate Action Group, striving to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. If you'd like to strive along with me, check out our new and improved Get Out the Vote volunteer opportunities by going to the indivisiblevashon.org website, click on the banner at the top of the page, and join in the fun to get those election outcomes that we really want to see. Okay, per our usual practice, let's take a moment to check in with everybody about what special things you experienced this last week. Bruce, could we start with you? In addition to COVID.
A special week of 5 days of isolation.
Seen any good movies?
In one room that's about 15 by 15 feet. Oh. And we actually emerged without killing each other.
Yeah, so that's good.
It was an amazing event. But other than that, sort of getting settled in Australia, getting out. Last week we went to Healesville Wildlife Preserve and saw all the kangaroos and wombats and all that kind of stuff, platypus, all the kind of neat Australian animals. And then students did a tour of the Melbourne Chinese Museum, which has a very interesting Chinese presence in Melbourne from the gold rush in the 1850s on. And then a visit to Banjalika, which is an Aboriginal part exhibit at the Melbourne Museum. We're relatively new, about 3-4 years old exhibit, and just incredible sort of telling the story of the local Wurundjeri people from the Melbourne area. So, and this afternoon we're down to the State Library, which is actually, it's the reading room is designed after the reading room at the British Library. So if you've ever been to the British Library in London, it's this great rotunda with this desk in the middle where all the books come out and then are distributed around the room. But it's also just a gorgeous Victorian building. So we'll spend the afternoon sort of in amongst the books and at the State Library of Victoria. So active things going on.
Great.
And of course, Friday is Australia Day, which kind of their 4th of July. but also gets is a contested holiday, to say the least. Many Aboriginal people celebrate it as Invasion Day versus Australia Day. So lots of protests, lots of music, lots of outdoor activities. And, of course, it's the middle of the summer. You know, it's been mostly 75, 80 degrees. No. And even this morning with the rainstorm, it's warm.
Yeah, lovely.
All right, Craig, how's your week been going?
Good. Before I touch on that, did you see any quokkas at the wildlife center there? The little smiling guys who look like they're always in selfies?
No, he did not. I'm not familiar with that animal.
You have to check them out.
Shoot me the term.
They're a bird. It's a bird, right?
No. It's a. I think it's a.
I know what it is. Yeah, I know what it is. Yeah. They have a little smiley face.
They always got a big smile on their face. Our guest today could probably address that issue.
She could.
My week was multifaceted, but just two things stood out. Yesterday, of course, here, it was movie rain for part of the day, and was also the day that one of our trees decided to drop a big branch on our horse shelter and put a hole in the top of our food area of the horse shelter. So I was out there with my little portable drill and some aluminum my neighbors, Jeff and Carol Sayre, just happened to have exactly the right configuration of aluminum roofing. So I was able to replace it, and I appreciate them even delivering the piece to the house, which was service with a quokka smile. The other thing was last Friday I went to the Coop, our local juke joint on the island, and the Mortgage Lifters were playing a lot of stuff from the 20s and 30s and 40s, great music, violin, bass, mandolin, guitar, which reminds me, Chris Anderson, who owns the Coop and is one of the one of the musicians and owners of the place. He's going to be joining us here on the show on February 20th and talk about the history of the Coop and the philosophy and the music on Vashon in general. So that was a good part of my week.
Nice. Truman, how's things looking on your end?
Well, I had a music week as well. On last Wednesday, I went into the city and to Jazz Alley. And Chris Bode, the jazz trumpet player, was playing with his band. And I think it was maybe one of the best musical events I've ever attended. It was so exciting. And he plays with such emotion. And he had two guests, well, actually had three guests, but two that really stood out. One was a young woman named Carolyn Campbell, violinist. And she was amazing on the violin, just fantastic. And I have to just tell you this one thing. He had friends that were up visiting from Oregon. He's originally from Portland. And they were sitting at a table just behind and to my right. And he and the violinist came over and stood right at their table. So he was standing 6 inches from me playing, and she was about 5 feet away and playing this incredible song, Emmanuel, which is just unbelievably beautiful. Anyway, I was completely blown away, I can tell you. And we ended up spending the night in the city, awesome. And I came home the next day. It was great. Anyway, so that was my week.
Oh, sounds tremendous. Claire, how has things been going with you?
Well, listening to all of the rest of you just reminds me that I need to occasionally leave my desk and try to get something of a life. Can't say I've had much of one in the past week. I'm normally pretty busy trying to manage my law firm and the nonprofit. And the last week has really had me tied up with a very challenging legislative session starting. So yeah. I've been lucky to find the time to take Zelda and Dipper out for walks. That's my big break in the day.
I was hoping you'd comment on how things were going with Zelda, Dipper, Volusaur, and Pearl, Buckbeak, Flitchy, and Scrappy. So thank you for adding that in.
Well, Zelda and Dipper may very well add their own voices to the background while we're talking here. The others are chickens. They're relatively quiet on the outside. But
All right, fantastic. Let's see, my week. So we've recovered now from the cold snap, which means that the boat heaters are now switched over to boat warmers. The good news is it looks like I found where the water is leaking in. The only good news about a water leak on a boat is mine is fresh water, not salt water. So there's encouragement there. But we also, the festive Christmas lights and the Christmas tree and all that are now back into storage. And so we're looking forward to moving through winter and onward into spring here at the Jones household.
Great.
All right. So as we look to today, today, of course, is a significant day. It's U.S. is International Pi Day. And also in the U.S., it's International Handwriting Day. And just in case you need to know, tomorrow is National Compliment Day. Oh. So dust off your compliments and get ready for that tomorrow. Also on this day in 1997, Madeleine Albright, the first woman Secretary of State in the U.S. And in 1849, Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman to receive a medical degree in the United States. And to move away from historic women, in 1957, the toy company Wham-O produces the first Frisbee.
Wow. And the whole rest is history, as they say.
Absolutely. And our historian could weigh in on that, of course. I would say also in honor of today's guest, we are 12 days away from National Wolf Day, 31 days from World Bear Day, 141 days from National Cougar Day, and 203 days from International Wolf Day. So it's definitely some wildlife recognition coming up just in 12 days, National Wolf Day. Let's then, with that note, dive in to small talk with
before,
Claire Davis.
Before
Claire,
we do,
for those who may have...
Kevin, before we do, I need to tell you one very short wolf story. One of our pilots grew up in Ketchikan, and he and a bunch of his friends were out on a full moon night, brilliant full moon, clear skies, and they were out on this frozen lake. And while they were walking around on this lake, they saw a group of people that came out of the woods and was going across the lake very close to them. And they thought, what are those other people doing out here? Isn't that something? And once they got a little closer, they realized that it was a pack of wolves. And they went right by them, just went, didn't even pay any attention to them. They were very close. They said probably 50 feet and went right off the lake on the other side. But anyway, that always gave me chills just to think of that, being out there on a full moon night, seeing a pack of wolves run by. Anyway, sorry, had to tell that.
Amazing encounter.
Yeah.
Well, wolves and Claire have a definite bond of affection, and all the wolves in our neck of the woods will much appreciate Claire's work. For those, Claire, who may have missed your visit with us last March, you are an environmental and wildlife law attorney, also president and founder of Washington Wildlife First. So if you could please remind us about the goals of Washington Wildlife First and tell us when the organization was founded.
The organization was founded a little over 2 years ago. We've had a very busy 2 years so far. And our goals are to use advocacy, legal avenues and outreach to work to reform the management of fish and wildlife in Washington. In our view, fish and wildlife for far too long have been controlled by special interest groups representing hunters, anglers, trappers, and industry interests, when really fish and wildlife should be managed for all Washingtonians who gave permission to the government to manage our wildlife in the public trust, and the government just hasn't been doing that up till now very well. We are not anti-hunting. I answer that question a lot, but we do believe that the priority of Department of Fish and Wildlife should be conservation, not consumption, and that it has a lot of work to do to meet the challenges that it has to face to help wildlife survive global biodiversity loss, climate change, habitat loss, population growth, all of the challenges that are causing a real extinction crisis, not only here, but everywhere in the world.
Well, in fact, one of the things we talked about last time was your 2023 legislative goals, where you're really seeking to supplement the existing knowledge on the commission by bringing in outside science review of Department of Fish and Wildlife proposals and an overall department review to improve the protection of fish and wildlife. I'm just curious, Claire, if you could tell us in your legislative experience from last year, what ended up happening there are you advocating for those same bills this session?
Well, we were really pleased last year, Kevin, that the biggest provision that we were pushing for passed, which was an allocation of $300,000 to the Ruckelshaus House Center for a review of the Department of Fish and Wildlife with instructions to look at its ability to meet threats caused by climate change and biodiversity loss, the alignment of its mandate and its operations with its responsibility as a public trustee, its governance structure, funding model, accountability, transparency, and legal compliance, the impact of special interest influence. So that was funded through a budget proviso, and that study is now underway. They're actively doing interviews of stakeholders to put together that report. It was originally supposed to be finished by this summer, but I understand that they are delayed, but are still committing to get that report to us before the next legislative session in 2025. As to the other bills that you mentioned, they had to do with getting staff for Fish and Wildlife Commission. We had a bill to increase the compensation for the Fish and Wildlife Commissioners, who are currently really full-time volunteers. We've backed away from those this session because we're waiting to see what is produced from the Ruckelshaus report and hoping to put together a comprehensive reform package for next year.
All right, Truman, I think you maybe saw a press release.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the press release that came out of Governor Inslee's office last week, where he directed the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to create a more formal and consistent review process before a decision is made about destroying a wolf. I'm just curious, were you involved in that decision, and what do you think was going to happen from there?
We were involved in that decision. In fact, that decision was in response to an appeal that we filed with the governor. Just to give you a bit of history and how it evolved, Washington Wildlife First and 10 other wildlife advocacy organizations filed a rulemaking petition in September asking the Fish and Wildlife Commission to go into rulemaking to establish rules to regulate when the department could use taxpayer money to kill wolves. That petition was denied by a vote of 6-3, even though the commission didn't really take the time to give it serious consideration. Many of the commissioners were complaining that they did not have enough time to consider the petition because it was pushed through on a fast agenda, and we didn't get a chance to speak publicly to our petition. But in any case, that was it was denied by a vote of 6-3, and then we filed an appeal to the governor in November, which the statute gives us an opening to do, asking him to reverse that decision and order the department to go into rulemaking. He issued that order earlier this month, so that's what you saw the press release about, was in response to our appeal of the denial of our rulemaking petition. So he's now ordered the commission to open a rulemaking process to develop rules that would regulate when the department can kill wolves, and also to develop rules to close a big loophole which exists in current law under the so-called Caught in the Act provision. Livestock owners can kill wolves if they are caught in the act of attacking livestock. Unfortunately, this provision is written so loosely that it invites a lot of abuse, and we've analyzed the incident reports of the 9 wolves have been killed under this act and found that 7 were not actually in the act of attacking, but it was very difficult for the investigators to assemble enough evidence to bring charges there. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping to close that loophole. We're hoping to put in place a rule with a protocol that the department has to actually follow before it kills wolves, because it has a very unfortunate history of not following its internal protocol. And when I've challenged it in court several times, writing that protocol off as only guidance, which means it doesn't need to follow the protocol because it's not in, in rule form. We're hoping to bring an end to that and decrease the number of wolves that the department kills.
Mm-hmm. So, Claire, talking about sort of controlling wolf populations, I mean, two sort of questions. It's how close did wolves come to being extinct here in Washington, being sort of killed out? And the second part of the question is, right now it seems like individual wolves, successful breeding pairs, wolf packs, continue to increase in state. And that's one of the reasons that we're seeing these sort of conflicts, if you will, over particularly from ranchers, over predation of their cattle by wolves. What's going on there?
Well, to answer your question, wolves were completely extirpated from Washington and did not come back into Washington until probably around 2007. We had the first confirmed pack a little bit later than that, through migration from Idaho, largely as a result of the wolves that were brought into Yellowstone. So wolves were completely gone until very recently. We have seen a wolf population grow since those first wolves came into the state, and there is now a population of 216 wolves by the last official count that the department did. That number has been growing most years. One of our concerns is that growth rate has significantly flattened. The department likes to say that the growth rate is 20%, but that includes very early years when there were only a handful of wolves. So a handful more wolves would be 100% growth. But over the last 2 years, each year it only grew by 5%. And of great concern is in those last 2 years, we've also seen a doubling of wolf mortality from an average of about 12 wolves killed each year by human-related causes to 30 over the past 2 years. So we see a real flattening of the wolf curve. And unfortunately, we are not on the verge of recovering wolves in Washington yet. The wolf recovery plan divides Washington into three big territories. And the biggest of those, the South Cascades and coastal region, does not have a meaningful wolf presence yet. We had hoped that wolves had established a breeding pair there last year, the Big Muddy Pack, they had named it. But from recent reports, it looks like the female wolf of that pack has probably died, and there is only one wolf remaining in that area in Klickitat County. So we are far away from the point where we can declare wolves recovered because they have to spread across the rest of Washington. Right now, most of the packs are centered in eastern Washington, northeastern Washington in particular. And they haven't really spread the way we'd hope that they would through the rest of the state. One thing that I found quite discouraging was a report that the department released, done by some scientists at the University of Washington last year, which told us, under different scenarios, what the likelihood of wolf recovery was in the next 50 years, meaning wolves reaching the recovery goals of the state wolf plan. And it found that under current mortality levels, the current level of take through tribal hunts, we had less than 50% chance of reaching wolf recovery over the next 50 years. That's really depressing, especially when you're looking 50 years out. I would hope that the percentages would be much, much higher than that. And I think it emphasizes the need for us to find ways to decrease the mortality of wolves promote their recovery. And decreasing the mortality, we have to look in many different directions. We hope through our rulemaking that we'll decrease the number of wolves that the department kills. The department has killed 43 wolves to date. We hope that we will decrease the number of wolves killed through the Cottonee Act provision. There have been 9 wolves killed that way so far, and those numbers are on the rise significantly in recent years. And we have to find a way to get a handle on wolf poaching. Just last year, actually now in 2022, I suppose, I'm used to it being 2023 and referring to it as last year, but I need to make a calendar adjustment. So in 2022, we had 9 wolves killed through poaching, including 6 in a mass poisoning that wiped out an entire pack.
So, and, Claire, give us some perspective. Claire, give us some perspective in terms of, I mean, there's what, 230 wolves in Washington right now, roughly. What does recovery look like? I mean, is it 1,000? Is it 800? What are we looking at?
Recovery doesn't require a certain number of wolves. I think there are estimates about how many wolves it might be. Instead, it requires number of breeding pairs established in each recovery region for a certain number of years. So, for example, for wolves to be downlisted from state endangered to state threatened, the wolf recovery plan requires there to be 6 successful breeding pairs present for 3 consecutive years. We've reached that certainly in the state, but what we haven't reached are 2 successful breeding pairs in each of the 3 recovery regions, because the point of the plan was to spread wolves throughout the state. So we have no breeding pairs yet in the biggest recovery region of the state, and that's what we really need to work on.
You know, I just thinking about predation in particular, and I was thinking that, you know, I would assume that food supply has a big factor in the spread of the packs. And I remembered reading a Farley Mowat a few years ago, Never Cry Wolf, and where he described that the main predation were rodents and rabbits and that sort of thing, where large animal predation was pretty limited. And so I'm wondering, do you see that as a factor of the spread of the packs, what's available, the available food supply?
No, I haven't seen anything that tells me that prey supply is a reason that wolves are not moving. I think the problem with wolves spreading throughout the state is we have to allow wolves to reach a great enough concentration where they are now in the northeastern part of the state, largely in the area of the Colville National Forest, to give them some incentive to move on. And this is where the lethal action taken by the Department of Fish and Wildlife is of great concern, because in prime wolf habitat, in the middle of Colville Forest, you know, area, it's densely wooded, steep. You go there and you say, this is wolf country. But unfortunately, U.S. Forest Service also has decided that it's cattle pasture. So 75% of the wolves that the Department of Fish and Wildlife has killed so far have been in Colville National Forest on public lands, because the livestock owners turn their cattle out at the beginning of the spring, and you know, many of them have evolved and now have very, very good non-lethal provisions in place to protect their cattle from wolves and other predators as well. But a certain number of them just turn them cattle out in the spring and hope they come back in the fall. And in between spring and fall, they don't have any human supervision or human protection. So I would say, of course, the wolves are going to prey on some. I've always been surprised that wolves don't prey on more cattle, in fact, under those circumstances. And unfortunately, the department's response has been to kill wolves in the Colville Forest year after year. In fact, it's killed, eliminated 3 consecutive packs over 4 years in just a couple of grazing allotments where we had this repeated problem of livestock owners not using non-lethal deterrents to protect their cattle. So we really need to put a stop to that, the continued killing of wolves in that area, so that the wolves will concentrate enough to have some incentive to leave. It's beautiful wolf country. Why would you leave unless, you know, you're a young wolf looking to strike out and form your own pack and there's no available territory nearby? That has to happen, and that has to happen in the next area they move to, and then the next area they move to really give an incentive to fill in the Southern Cascades region.
Claire, Craig here. You know, we've been talking at some length, probably not enough, but we've been talking at some length about wolves. I'm curious if Washington Wildlife First has some successes in other areas, other kinds of animals. As you know, in Vashon, we've had some unfortunate experiences with
with cougars, and unfortunate in the sense that they had to be, or at least it was said they had to be euthanized by the wildlife department. And bears. So do you deal with those two animals?
We do, and in fact, we deal with all species. We're working at different times on, you know, harlequin ducks to beavers, to bears, and cougars. So we really are focused on increasing and protecting biodiversity in Washington State, and that means trying to protect lots of animals that you never hear about, the non-game animals that don't get much attention from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, as well as the more prominent species that you hear a lot about, like wolves and cougars and bears. On cougars and bears specifically, we had a fantastic win last month when the Fish and Wildlife Commission approved one of our rulemaking petitions by a vote of 7-2, asking it to take another look at the bear and cougar hunting rules, which we think have led to drastic overhunting in the past several years and are putting those populations at risk. Just over the last four years, as a result of a change that the commission made in 2019, bear mortality through hunting has gone up 50%. And the department will say and has said in its reports that it doesn't know what impact that has had on the bear population because it's not very good at measuring trends in the bear population. And bears reproduce so slowly that by the time we can tell that that is having an impact, it could have already really devastated the population, point where it could take a decade or longer for it to recover. So we don't know if we've passed that point. And in the face of uncertainty, we believe it's imperative for the department to take action now to rein in the increased hunting of bears and to bring that the number of bears killed by hunters every year back down to a sustainable number. Cougars are a little bit different. There were some really awful changes to cougar hunting rules a few years ago as a result of pressure brought by a small group of people that were impatient to hunt more predators, bears, cougars, and ideally wolves, though they understood that wasn't allowed at the moment. Due to this pressure, the department enacted just awful rules that took it away from a science-based cougar management policy, which was really a leading policy around the country, founded on science that the department's researchers had done over decades about the state cougar population, and just increased quotas around the state, leaving that policy in the dust. As a result, we've seen continued air pockets of the state where cougars have been overhunted, especially when you combine the hunting levels with a dramatically increased number of cougars killed through lethal control actions, as the cougars that came to Vashon were. In almost all cases, those lethal control actions are not necessary and they are not helpful, and science has shown that they can actually create more cougar conflicts and make it more dangerous, cougar conflicts that are more dangerous to humans because it disrupts the whole cougar social structure. It brings more young cougars into the area with increased density, and the type of cougars who are more likely to get in conflict with humans. So as with wolves, the department, unfortunately, its first instinct is all too often to take lethal action to control predators, even though the science from its own department tells it that this simply doesn't work. And lethal control almost never solves problems because the problem is almost always something that humans are doing that creates a conflict in the first place. And if you don't address what humans are doing, then you can keep killing cougars. Cougars will keep coming in and they'll cause more problems. So we are hoping that our rulemaking will move the department away from that mindset and will also cause it to rein in the hunting of cougars and bears to sustainable levels, because we're very worried about what's happening with both those populations right now.
Go ahead, Bruce. You had.
Oh, I just had a question about coyotes. How do they fit into this equation? I mean, We've seen a fairly significant increase in coyote population on Vashon. And, you know, I know the Vashon Nature Center has a coyote tracking program. I just wondered how that fit into this.
Well, we would certainly like to see the rules on coyotes changed. Right now, they are not even classified as a game animal, and there are essentially no rules on when you can kill coyotes. You can kill them year-round, round the clock, using virtually any method with no limit to the number you can kill. And we see, you know, tons of disturbing pictures as we look through, you know, logs of hunters just gunning down as many cougars as they can, and then leaving them in the field because there's not even any requirement for, I mean, sorry, coyotes. There's not even a requirement that if you kill a coyote, you need to use the coyote, the meat or the fur or anything else. You can just leave it to waste. So that's very disturbing. And we're hoping that within the next year, the commission may pass a rule to at least make coyotes a game species, which means they can start to regulate the hunting of coyotes and start to rein that in a little bit. But I would say that coyotes are kind of the perfect example of where killing just doesn't work to solve problems, because coyotes, they're an amazing species that when you kill coyotes, they produce more coyotes to compensate for the number of coyotes that you've killed. So we can keep killing all the coyotes that we want to, but they are just remarkably resilient and they will persist, and we will create our own problems as the coyote population kind of explodes in response to us killing more of them. It's just an insane circle that we're in that is not a good management approach, but the department allows it to continue. U.S. Wildlife Services continues killing coyotes, even though we all know very well that that does not resolve conflicts with coyotes.
So not to go back to wolves, but I was thinking about the relationship of people to wolves and vice versa. And I remember reading an extensive study that they did on the Yellowstone repopulation and the changes that occurred to the environment around this return of the wolves, including willow growth along streams and all sorts of things. I'm just wondering, is that still a valid study? And is this something that you folks have seen a change in the environment for those areas that if wolves have been reestablished?
That's certainly something that we continue to see, not just with wolves, but with other predators, especially, you know, apex predators at the top of the food chain. Not just wolves, but other predators were largely wiped out in many areas. As we see them repopulate, we see, you know, the whole ecosystem revitalized because they are an important part of the puzzle. That's why we're encouraging the department and the commission to take a whole ecosystem approach to management, where you don't just look at, okay, how many wolves are there? Are there enough wolves that we can say they're recovered? How many cougars are there? Can we kill more cougar? But you look at the role that wolves play in the ecosystem, the role that cougars play in the ecosystem, and acknowledge that all these different components are necessary to have a healthy and resilient ecosystem that will help all the species within it to survive climate change and, you know, other challenges. But the results that you see are just remarkable. There's one study recently that showed a dramatic decrease in car accidents with deer as a result of a wolf population coming back to the area. Not so much because wolves decimated the deer population, they didn't, although they do serve as an important control mechanism, but because with that apex predator back on the scene, the deer are more wary. They're less likely to be congregated in roads and in open places where they cause so many vehicle accidents. That can be obviously quite serious. So there are all sorts of good things that a healthy wolf population brings to the environment. And certainly the revitalization of the ecosystem is a big part of that, especially in riparian areas, which otherwise tend to be really hammered by ungulates if they aren't controlled by a healthy apex predator in the area. Again, not so much to decrease the numbers, but to cause them to be wary enough so they just don't hang out in the stream all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Claire, can you tell us a little bit about your priorities for the upcoming legislative session? What are you hoping to get passed here in the next few months?
Well, we are hoping to see the passage of Senate Bill 5846, which would direct the department to establish a beaver management plan that recognizes the vital role that beavers play in the ecosystem and comes up with strategies to reduce beaver mortality, especially in key ecosystem areas where we really need beavers to come back to create healthier streams and better environment for salmon and other fish, and you know, a better environment for all species in that area. Going back to ecosystem management, beavers are the best tool that we have to fight climate change and to allow other species to survive climate change. And we need to figure out a better way to coexist with beavers to allow them to do the amazing job that they do in stopping the spread of forest fires, preventing catastrophic flooding, cleaning water, cooling the air, cooling streams, because that helps not only the other species in the ecosystem, it helps us as well. And, but a army of beavers can do work that we could spend tens of millions of dollars to try to do and not achieve results that were nearly as successful. So this plan would be an important first step toward a rational beaver management plan that would recognize the good that beavers can do for all of us and try to reduce their mortality. Other than that, there are a few other good bills out there, but largely this legislative session for us is about making sure that some really awful bills do not pass. Yeah, we're holding our fire largely until the next session when we're hoping to look at the Rusthaus study and introduce some reform legislation.
So that's a perfect segue into what I was going to ask, and that is, so what bills are there that are going the opposite direction?
One bill that I testified about yesterday, I guess it was yesterday, is Senate Joint Resolution 8208, which would create a constitutional right to hunt amendment. That amendment, I don't think it's going to pass this session. If it did pass this session, and it would require 2/3 votes in both houses, then it would go on the popular ballot and the citizens of Washington would have to pass it as well. So I think its odds of getting through all those hurdles are very slim, but if it did, it would be quite devastating because it would instill an inalienable right to hunt, fish, and trap in the state constitution and really limit the ability for the legislature or the commission to enact measures to control hunting and fishing and trapping for conservation purposes. There's an exception that allows reasonable regulation, but that would be then put to the courts to determine on potentially any regulation, whether it was reasonable. It would have an enormous chilling effect on taking steps that we need to conserve biodiversity. We're also opposing three terrible wolf bills. Those come up pretty much every year, but SB 5939, which would allow livestock owners basically to bait and kill wolves near the scene of where wolves or any other animal potentially had preyed on livestock, and a couple of House bills, 2424 and 2423, which would dramatically change wolf management in the eastern part of the state, that same area where I talked about it's so important to build up the concentration of wolves to allow more wolves to be killed there. And actually, as we speak, there's a hearing going on about a Senate bill or House Bill 2293, which would create a work group aimed at killing more birds that are preying on salmon. And we are opposing that as well. So we have our hands full largely just hanging on for this short session and making sure nothing too catastrophic happens.
It sounds like you're pretty active. with the legislature. And I think we all appreciate the work you do. Could you tell our listeners about how they could get involved, how they learn more about your organization, and how they can support your work?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking that. I think the best way would be to go to our website, which is www.washingtonwawildlifefirst.org, or the easiest way to find us is just to Google Washington Wildlife First, and we come up, I think, as the first result now. Go to the Contact Us page on our website, sign up for updates, or send us an email and let us know that you'd like to talk to us and learn more about what we do.
Wonderful. Thank you, Claire, for that summary. I will let our listeners know that the Take Action Network features a lot of the legislation, Claire, that you just talked about, and that we are working really closely together to get those actions out so people know when to call their legislators to go in opposition or support of a bill. And so our listeners probably already know that if they go out to bit.ly, which is bit.ly/VashonTan, so capital V is in Vashon, and spell out Vashon, the rest lowercase, then capital T, capital A, capital N. It'll give you an opportunity to join that action network, and you're going to hear some of this legislation that Claire's talking about and then how you can influence it one way or the other. I'll share a brief wolf story as well. Arctic Wild, it's a book written by Lois Chrysler. Herb and Lois spent a lot of time on the Olympic Peninsula, but when they did some filming of the elk, they were invited to also go up to the Brooks Range in Alaska. And the Chryslers ended up asking the local trappers there to save out two wolf pups for them so they could take the wolf as their pets into the wild when they did the filming on the Brooks Range. And as they moved in the summer up into the Brooks Range, those wolves, of course, you know, roamed around the territory. And the book has a delightful story about how the alpha wolf that was in their family, you know, Herb and Lois. I think Herb was actually the alpha because they actually worked as pet, you know, were like behaved as pets. But they went out and found another wolf pack with another alpha wolf, and they introduced the alpha wolf pack in the wild. They brought them back to see Herb and Lois, is the way Lois describes this. So the amazing social structure and a little bit of insight there that might be of interest to our listeners. Wow. Arctic Wild, Lois Chrysler, is available now. It's an out-of-print book, but you can, I'm sure you can probably find it if you searched on the internet. All right. Hey, so why don't we dive into some other topics locally? I'm just curious with the latest announcement from our friends at the Washington State Ferry Service, which does give new meaning to the word service. I'm curious if anyone attended the weigh-in on ferries meeting on the 17th and 18th.
Unfortunately, I did not. I was hoping, Kevin, you did.
We're going to have to put our ears to the rail, but I do know in the Beachcombers doing a great job. Shout out to the Vashon Be Prepared group for joining forces with the Islanders for Ferry Action. And so we'll have to be keeping an eye on what transpires. The Islanders for Ferry Action already have a multiple point paper that they've delivered to WSF to help the situation. But I'm curious, just in a little brainstorming here, what new and creative methods do you hope to see Islanders take to both keep Vashon weird and reduce their ferry footprint? Any ideas that people have?
Well, I don't know how weird it would keep Vashon, but, you know, of all those options that the chamber came up with, that 25-page report, one of the ones that I thought would make a significant difference and help the community out is if we had some sort of emergency medical, not a full ICU,
urgent care.
Yeah, urgent care, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's right. So that you weren't put to the task of trying to get off of the island in a hurry. If a lot of people don't have helicopter insurance or it wouldn't work. Helicopter insurance, by the way, is not very expensive in terms of what you get for it. So people who haven't got that should look into it. But urgent care on the island would help out a lot of people, especially as our demographic gets a little older.
Which we are doing daily.
Okay, well, I was thinking maybe, you know, Stupid Bike Night could go to a daily commute auction. might be something. And I was just wondering how many Segways does it take to fill up the space of a car? I think it's probably like at least an 8-to-1 for Segways versus cars, and vans and trucks, you know, could be 10 or 12 to 1. So maybe Island E-Bikes ought to go to e-bike e-Segway and you know, offer some other electric powered commuting options that are less of a ferry footprint.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll get the creative juices flowing, and maybe somebody from the Islanders for Ferry Action are listening in. All right, so another item of, I'm sure, keen interest to our listeners. In the Iowa caucuses, apparently the former guy pegged the largest margin of victory with the lowest voter turnout in 20 years. Does that tell us anything?
Tells us the temperature was really cold in Iowa.
Yeah, no kidding. Nobody wanted to get out and to do it.
I don't know what it tells us. Bruce, you got an opinion on that one?
Well, I mean, what you said, I mean, low voter turnout and severe weather conditions tend to, you know, only the truest believers tend to come out in those kind of conditions. So that gives us something. Yeah, I think the real question is going to be what happens in New Hampshire. And we'll know that tonight. I mean, that's going to be tonight, your time. It's going to be really interesting to see whether or not Nikki Haley with DeSantis out of the race can poise any kind of opposition to Trump. I mean, it's going to come down to the vote tonight, I think, to give a sense of whether this is a steamroller coming through or whether there's some opportunities to direct the Republican Party to its more traditional roots.
Well, you know that Dixville Notch came in all Haley, you know, 6 votes. That was it.
Well, you know, Bruce, can't you tell us who won? You are in.
That's right. You're tomorrow.
You're already tomorrow.
Let's see. The great Karnak says that.
We'll look forward to that. And Truman, did you have another comment, or you're just giving us the time signal?
Just giving the time signal.
Okay. Okay, well, we are in our time zone, as in all time zones. We are within 5 hours of the presidential primary election polls closing in New Hampshire. So you've heard some predictions here. I was thinking that the low turnout and the highest margin of victory was exactly that the cold weather promotes just the loyalists. And so we're seeing that a strong majority can really support the former guy. Let's see, in a few minutes we have left, I know, and I'm going to call Claire on you to get your thoughts about this. Speaking of upcoming elections, it seems that we have an unusual number of state executive office vacancies coming up at the end of the year: the governor, attorney general, insurance commissioner, and also public lands commissioner. Claire, what can you tell us maybe about the public lands commissioner and what effect it might have on Washington life?
Really an enormous impact, because the public lands commissioner controls the sale of timber in the state for cutting. And we've been really disappointed in Hillary Frans that she's continued to allow the devastation of mature forests in the western part of the state. Of course, we have very little old growth left because that was all log, but we did have mature forests that were on their way toward becoming old growth. And we've continued under Hillary Frans to really decimate that habitat. So we're certainly hoping for a new public lands commissioner that will reverse that trend.
Okay, well, you know, speaking of Hillary Frans, she's no longer running for governor. She is running for a Congress seat in CD6, which is out on the peninsula. And Emily Randall, who is in that same district, is also running. So the importance of lands commissioner that Hillary is vacating, Hillary's record there and what she would do to continue that record of service in CD6 may be of interest to our listeners. I thank everybody for joining us here. Claire, Bruce, Craig, Truman, and myself, really thanks for joining the Briefly. And let's see, next week, Tuesday, is the Truman Show. And Truman, any insights into what might be top of mind for you for next week?
I'll probably have a really good idea probably about Monday night. No, I'll be working on it over the weekend. And, you know, I generally try and do a do a review of the previous month, but actually I may, being this is January, I may do a review of the previous year and just kind of see what kind of things we talked about earlier in the year and what kind of changes occurred and if we had any effect on that.
We look forward to the mind unhinged.
Yeah. There you go.
You know it's there, don't you?
Okay, you heard it here first. So looking ahead, Bruce, thank you so much for tuning in from Wednesday, and everybody else, thanks for joining us on Tuesday.
Thank you very much.
See y'all next
week. Thanks so much.